Good afternoon and welcome back to Community Forum Radio. We're now here with Ellen Frank. Ellen Frank is Senior Economic Analyst at Rhode Island College and a member of the Dollars and Cents Collective. And if you read Dollars and Cents, you might also know her as Dr. Dollar. Ellen, I want to welcome you to Community Forum Radio. How are you?
I'm good, Tony. Thanks.
Well, great. Let's go ahead and start with some of the recent news we've been getting around the economy that to me, it comes to me in a flash, you know, in a news broadcast, and it never seems to register exactly what they're talking about. And one of the things we're hearing about lately is inflation and interest rates. And if you could kind of break down for us what are the worries around inflation and how interest rates relate to inflation, I think that would help us out a lot.
Okay, well, I'll be happy to, and I'd like to just mention at the outset that I also have just published a new book called The Raw Deal, How Myths About Deficits, Inflation, and Wealth Impoverish America. And one of the arguments of this book is that the stuff that you do read in the media about inflation is largely very misleading and very biased toward a perspective on how the economy works and a point of view that reflects the interests of the financial industry and the banking industry and Wall Street firms. And so let me explain what I mean by that. Inflation is a term for an average general rise in overall prices. And generally, when economies are growing very rapidly, and when unemployment rates are pretty low, and when people are pretty secure in their bargaining power, you know, at their jobs, if there's any kind of shock to the system, like for example in the 1970s, there was an oil price shock. Prices increased, quadrupled of oil coming from the Middle East as a result of the actions of OPEC. Then what's going to happen is that most people, most workers, most small businesses, most large corporations, because the economy is very tight and is running very hot, are going to be able to pass those price increases along, and that's going to turn into what economists call accelerating inflation. You see a 10% rise in your cost of living, you go to your boss for a 10% wage increase, your boss gives you the wage increase because he can't replace you, and now he raises prices by 10% to cover those higher costs, and then you realize that prices are rising, so you want a greater increase to compensate you for the rising of other prices, and so on and so forth and so on and so forth. And so what happened during the 1970s is that inflation just kept rising year after year after year after year. But that didn't mean that people's standard of living was falling, because most people were in a position to bargain for wage increases that kept themselves whole and that protected themselves against inflation. Now, the Federal Reserve is a quasi-private, quasi-public institution. The chairman of the Federal Reserve Bank is Alan Greenspan, and it is empowered to raise interest rates so as to promote economic growth and prevent inflation. And what the Federal Reserve does is when they believe that inflation is getting too high, they will raise interest rates in the hope that consumers will buy less and businesses will buy less and they'll borrow less. And with less demand, workers will get laid off. And with more layoffs, people won't have any bargaining power. And with no bargaining power, they won't be able to push for higher wages. And that won't feed into an inflationary spiral in the economy. So the question is, why would the Federal Reserve want to weaken the bargaining power of ordinary working class Americans vis-a-vis their employers? And the answer to that question is because the Federal Reserve is mostly listening to its primary constituency are large Wall Street interests and financial interests, and large Wall Street interests and financial interests, large banks, are very, very significantly hurt by inflation, much more than they are so by unemployment, whereas ordinary people are much more hurt by unemployment, much more so than they are by inflation.
So would it be safe to say that inflation in the short term is in fact good for folks, especially folks who have debt?
Yes, it is good for people who have debt, because inflation means generally that if prices are going up 5% and your income is going up 5% or 6% or 8% or 10%, and you have a home mortgage that has a fixed rate of interest and a fixed monthly payment, then everything is going to be going up relative to that fixed payment. And that's why, and that is exactly why banks hate inflation, because whenever there's inflation, all of the loan agreements and these contractual debts that they have issued over the years become less and less valuable, and they can get less and less income out of them. And in fact, the people who borrowed money are from them rather than they are the ones who tend to benefit in inflationary times. So inflation is good for people who've borrowed and bad for people who've lent. It's generally good for people, but moreover, it's generally also fairly good, and inflation is usually associated with pretty tight labor markets, because it's the tightness of the labor market that leads to the inflationary pressures in the first place. And since most people are much better off when unemployment rates are low, generally people will do better in a moderate inflation environment with low unemployment than they will in a low inflation environment with high unemployment. And right now, the unemployment rate in the United States has been hovering around 6% for a couple of years. And despite that, the Federal Reserve just raised interest rates because they're afraid that the economy is beginning to grow just fast enough to give workers a little more bargaining power and perhaps set off inflation.
Well, on the other side of the coin, you know, we hear a lot of scare stories about deflation, and I'm wondering if you could kind of break that down for us as well.
Well, deflation is the opposite of inflation. Inflation is when prices on average all start to go up and the value of money becomes less valuable. Deflation is when prices on average start to fall and money becomes more valuable. And deflation is very, very harmful to people who have borrowed money. The Federal Reserve actually was quite worried about a potential for deflation a couple of years ago because American households and businesses are really heavily indebted. American households have been borrowing at about double the rate of at which their income has been increasing for a number of years now, which means that people's debt loads are increasing and the percentage of income that goes toward debt servicing increases. So let's say that you have a monthly debt load of $1,000 a month, a student loan and auto loan, stuff like that, and your prices start to fall, and that means that if prices start to fall, your wage is going to fall because your employer isn't earning enough money to keep you at the same wage. That doesn't necessarily mean that prices are more expensive for you relative to your wage. It could be that your prices fall by more or less. But what is going to be happening is that $1,000 is a payment that you have to make on that debt stays fixed while your income is falling. And so deflation is very bad for borrowers and very good for lenders. Except that lenders used to actually like inflation. I remember once when I worked on Wall Street years ago, a banker telling me that what this country needs is a good deflation. They actually said that in the 1970s. But bankers used to like deflation, but they have come to recognize, I think, that the Federal Reserve, in trying to prevent deflation, is doing them a favor, because once you let a deflationary spiral get started, firms tend to lay off workers, people default on their loans, and the economy can really get into a bad, very, very deep recession.
Well, before you mentioned unemployment hovering somewhere around 6%, I know there are a lot of questions about how that's calculated. Could you talk to us about how that's calculated and whether you think that 6% figure is accurate or not?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's accurate as far as the numbers go. The actual rate at the last month for the last recorded unemployment rate was for June, and the June unemployment rate was 5.6%, and it's been stuck at about 5.6% for a few months now. It had come down from 6.2% a year ago. Now, it used to be that dollars and cents would write articles about how the unemployment rate was calculated, and this was really kind of earth-shaking news. Nobody else was reporting this. But in recent years, I think the mainstream press has really grabbed onto this story, and certainly people like Paul Krugman and the New York Times have increased people's awareness of how inadequate the unemployment figures are. The problem is that the Bureau of Labor Statistics, which calculates the unemployment rate, defines anybody who has worked for pay at all in the past week as employed. And that means that if you are a migrant worker who got 5 hours of work, or a you know, 10 hours of part-time landscaping work and you're not sure that you're going to be able to get full-time work or get work next week, you would still be considered employed. And so that tends to really make the unemployment rate look better than it is, because you're counting all these people as employed who are, in fact, you know, economically, you know, heavily underemployed, significantly underemployed. Then on the other way in which the Bureau of Labor Statistics makes the unemployment rate sound lower than, I'm trying to think of the right way to put this, it makes the unemployment rate sounds lower than the actual experience of people who are in the labor market, is that they don't count people who have what they call dropped out of the labor force. And if you stop actively looking for work, if you give up looking because you can't find anything, because you've sent your resume everywhere and nobody's called you back, or you've applied to every store in the neighborhood and, you know, everybody knows you and you can't go around again and again and again, for whatever reason, if you give up looking for a period of time, they will consider you to have dropped out of the labor force and to no longer be an active job seeker, and so you won't be counted as unemployed anymore. And that tends to make the unemployment rate look lower. Now, it is possible, by the way, to find out exactly how many people are not counted for these reasons. The Bureau of Labor Statistics does keep records of this, and you can go to their website and click on, their databases and find out how many discouraged workers and people who have left the labor force for economic reasons or are part-time employed for economic reasons. And it's a really significant number. If you added all those people back in, the unemployment rate would be more around 10%.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, part of the conversation that we've had is trying to get at some of the things that we constantly hear, whether it's statistics about unemployment or interest rates or inflation. And the funny thing that strikes me is part of the problem is, one, we're not really taught economics, but two, it seems that the perspective is skewed in a way that doesn't necessarily benefit most folks. And I think a good example of that is, you know, I can't listen to a broadcast on the radio without hearing an update from the stock market every hour, as if, you know, I've got to unload my stock right away. Can you talk about when did that happen, where our lives are kind of pegged to the stock market in a way that I think is disingenuous?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's actually the sort of topic of the theme of the my book, The Raw Deal, is that it's not so much that we aren't taught economics, but that what we're taught about economics is wrong. It's misleading. It misrepresents what people's real interest in the economy is. And the stock market is an excellent example of that. And I would say the stock market kind of, the idea, this constant media fascination with the stock market began. I worked on Wall Street in the early 1980s, and so I saw it then, although I don't think it really filtered down into sort of widespread popular, consciousness and media, constant media, these channels like CNBC that covered the Wall Street, you know, all day long. They sort of sprung up in the early 1990s. And when this happened, this is coincident with a huge shift, a seismic shift in economic policy in the United States. In the early 1980s, the Federal Reserve decided to try to halt inflation by essentially strangling the U.S. economy. And at the same time, Ronald Reagan, who took office in 1980, had a very deliberate agenda to try to weaken unions and reduce the role of government in the economy. So this was a real anti-employment, kind of anti-labor, anti-growth economic policy that was pursued at the very highest levels of the national government in the United States. And one of the consequences of that was that interest rates just soared in the early 1980s. The short-term rate on overnight bank lending, which is now 1.25%, rose to 21% when Volcker was chair of the Fed in the early years. And as interest rates rose and the returns on financial assets rose and inflation fell, then people who had lent money, Wall Street firms and banks, became wealthier. And they started, you know, pouring money into the stock market, stock market investors who had, you know, financial assets started putting pressure on corporate managers to pump up the profits and show high returns on stocks and not just on bonds and bank accounts. that stocks should pay equivalent returns. And so there was a big move in the United States to, you know, pump up profits. It was called the shareholder revolution, and to you know, buy and sell companies to try to increase the share price and lay off workers, downsize, outsource, right size, restructure to try to get your share price going. And at the same time, companies, as a tactic to increase their share price and increase their profitability, they cut traditional pension plans and instead put workers into these what we know as defined contribution plans or 401ks, IRAs, things like that. And that meant that a lot of, you know, ordinary people now suddenly were pouring money into the stock market too. Not large amounts of money, but large amounts of money for them, you know, for somebody who makes $40,000 a year. If you only have $10,000 in savings, and that's in the stock market, then the stock market suddenly looms very large in your mind. And so between 1980 and 2000, the percentage of Americans who own stock rose from about a quarter of the population to about half of the population. And what we started hearing during the early 90s was that the stock market was now democratic. Everybody was a stockholder. You know, the big guys on Wall Street were no different from the little old ladies in Beardstown, Pennsylvania, who were putting their own portfolio together, or the post office worker who had money, or not the post office worker because they have a pension, but the trucker who has a 401k and money in the stock market. They were all the same. We all have the same interest in the stock market. And what we found out in late 2000, you know, the turn of the new millennium, of course, was that this was not true, that we don't all have the same stake in the stock market, that some people have a way bigger stake than others, and they have way more information than others. And as more and more little folks were pouring money into the market, they were figuring out how to get out and turn this stock into cash. And so you had all these scandals of people like Ken Lay at Enron and Gary Winnick at Global Crossing and Phil Anschutz at Quest, who cashed in millions and hundreds of millions of dollars in stock market wealth and left these all these little 401k holders holding the bag.
Well, Ellen, we're to the end of the interview, but I'm wondering if you could give our readers two or three key books that might give them an introduction to better understanding the way economics works in this country and in this world.
Oh, well, thanks. That's a great question. It's so nice to be able to do that. Well, I would first of all recommend my own book. The name of it is The Raw Deal, and it's by Ellen Frank from Beacon Press, and it just came out a couple of weeks ago. And I recommend that strongly because it's intended for a general reader, and it's really sort of, you know, tries to explain things that some books don't, you know, assume that you know. I would also recommend a recent book by Robert Polin at University of Massachusetts in Amherst called Contours of Dissent. And it's really a sort of reflection on the shift in economic policy in the United States in the 80s and 90s and how you know, Reaganomics and Clintonomics sort of have led to growing inequality in the United States. And it's a very, very good book and a very interesting book. And the third book I would recommend on the economy, which I think everybody should read if they never have, is a rather old book by Robert Heilbronner called The Worldly Philosophers, which talks about the early economists and the debates in the 1800s between people like Karl Marx and Thorstein Veblen and Adam Smith and David Ricardo and these people who, you know, you learn about in history courses. And these debates are really interesting because they mirror very closely the kinds of things we argue about today.